There are two things that Americans love to watch. One is sports, and the other is a good fight. And sometimes you can watch both at the same time. Sports, just by their competitive nature, I think sometimes can easily give way to brawls and fights of different kinds. And it's in every sport. I mean, we could think of lots of examples from sports history, like the time in 1999 when Shaquille O'Neal and Charles Barkley traded blows on the court. Or how about the event in 2004 when the Pacers and the Pistons, in case you didn't know, basketball teams, got into a brawl which resulted in player suspensions, even in assault charges. And it was an ugly, ugly scene. It's not just basketball, all sports. Baseball has its notable brawls, of course. There's almost too many to mention, but we might think of times like when Nolan Ryan, the pitcher, gave a beat down to Robin Ventura right on the mound, which turned into a huge brawl. But when it comes to sports, there's none that can trump hockey for fights. In fact, hockey is known for this. Rodney Dangerfield, the comedian, once said, "I went to a fight and a hockey game broke out." That's people's perception. In fact, that's one of the reasons why people go to hockey games, is to see the fights. Now, perhaps you were following last week when the U.S. Olympic team beat the Canadians for Olympic gold. And it was a great moment. It was the first time the U.S. men's hockey team had claimed the prize since the famous Miracle on the Ice in 1980. But those two teams, U.S. and Canada, have some history together. Back in 2025, there was a game, a rather famous game, played between the U.S. and Canadian hockey teams in which there were three fights in the first 9 seconds of play. So in 9 seconds, three fights. Tempers flare. I mean, that happens on the court. It happens on the ice. It happens on the field. Why is that? Why do fights break out in sporting events? Again, I already said competition already has the tensions running high. And then you toss in the extreme ego that some of these players have, and it's a recipe for dynamite. You're ready for an explosion. But I suppose sports are, in some way, like a microcosm of our culture and our society. Everywhere you look, you see conflict. We see it on a large scale. Again, if you've been watching the news, you're watching fights and wars on television. But not just on that scale, you see it everywhere. You see it in the home, in the classroom. You see conflicts in churches and in cities and in countries and in government. There's hardly a place you can look where you won't find hostility and conflict at some point. I mean, what marriage has ever existed in which there was never conflict, in which there was never a disagreement or an argument? What siblings have ever gone through life without having a fight or a squabble between one another? What friendship has been untouched by conflict in one form or another? What town has ever never known a disagreement? What church has ever existed that didn't have some kind of rift at some point? And the question we ought to ask is, where does it all come from? Why can't people just get along in this world? Well, that's the question James is asking here in James chapter 4. He begins by asking, where do fights and quarrels come from? Where do these things trace back to? What is the cause of the fights we have? Why is it we can't live at peace? Well, James helps to diagnose this conflict. And in chapter 4, he reveals here in these first three verses that conflict is a symptom of a misaligned and sinful desires. Conflict is the symptom. It's not the root of it, but it's the symptom of desires that are wrong or misaligned. What lies beneath our troubles, what lies beneath the conflicts and the quarrels of our life are desires, oftentimes sinful desires. So James insists that we dig deeper. If we want to get to the bottom of why there's conflict in our world, in our lives, we have to dig into the root causes. And James won't let his readers just fly past this. He addresses it head on. Now, if you remember, this was going back a couple of weeks, James chapter 3 ends with this discussion on wisdom. Wisdom from above, wisdom from below. And the wisdom from above, he says, results in a harvest of righteousness and peace. What a wonderful, tranquil picture. But then he says, the wisdom that comes from below results in confusion and chaos and every evil thing. In other words, if we're to look at our lives and how things are working, we can trace backwards and say, well, what wrong thoughts, what wrong worldview has brought us to this point? And the same could be said with conflicts. It causes us to dig a little deeper than the surface. Now, as James unpacks this for us, he begins by asking some questions. It's really quite interesting how he uses these rhetorical questions to build his case. And in light of that, I decided to form our outline this morning based on a series of questions. So let's think about these questions and understand what James would want us to know. First question, where do conflicts in our lives come from? Where do conflicts in our lives come from? If things are tumultuous, why is that the case? Why do we have struggles in marriage and with our family members, with people at work, in our community? Well, if you were to ask two children who are fighting, why are you fighting? What are the kids going to do? They're the problem. They're going to point at the other. And this is what we often do. You know, if I picture James speaking to his audience. He says, where do conflicts come from? And our initial response is to say, well, they come from other people. That person over there, they're to blame. You know, we could get along if she would just fill in the blank. Or, you know, we could make this work if they wouldn't make such a big deal about such and such. Or if they would just listen to me, then we wouldn't have this conflict. And so it's always their fault. And I picture James looking at his audience and saying, nope, try again. So then we turn to our circumstances. Well, it's the circumstances of my life. I was raised in a home where conflict was normal, so that's where it comes from. Or maybe we point to things happening in our life currently. You know, I'm stressed at work. Things are hard. If I would just have a little personal space, things would be fine. And again, James shakes his head no and says, try again. Well, running out of excuses, I think James would walk up and put his finger squarely on our chest and say, the problem is right here. Look at this in James 4, verse 1. What causes quarrels and fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? So James asks this rhetorical question. What causes quarrels and fights among you? It's almost like he's breaking up a playground brawl and he says, what's going on? What happened? What's this all about? And he asks a rhetorical question, which, is a very effective means of teaching. But he mentions what causes quarrels and fights among you. Two words, quarrels and fights. The word quarrels refers to a extended or elongated conflict, whereas fights talks about a sudden explosion of hostility. Some versions will translate, I think rightly, what causes wars and fights among you. Because that's the idea. I say it's right because that's how these words were actually used. These are terms that were used for battlefield conflict, for wars and battles. So I think it's very appropriate that he calls it out this way. Now, James is using this metaphorically. He's not saying that his readers were wheeling out cannons and brandishing swords against each other. But he is saying the conflicts in your life are something like wars and battles. Here's the other interesting thing that I think he does with these two terms is he depicts the types of conflicts we have. There are wars and then there are battles. And battles usually fit inside of the wars. Conflicts in our lives run like this. You can have these long engagements, a war, if you will. You might have a war between a husband and wife. You might have a long-running war between siblings or coworkers or friends. And that war will occasionally burst out in sudden conflicts, in battles. So in a relationship, in a marriage, for instance, you might have individual battles that come up. You know, that the battle over this or that, individual battles that can be won or lost, but the war always rages in the background. Churches, by the way, also go through this. There are different sides to the conflict, and people choose sides, and the war can go on for years, but it's punctuated by different battles. In a church, you might have the battle over the budget, the battle over electing deacons, the battle over church cleaning schedule, the battle over nursery decorations, whatever it might be. Here's the question, though. What causes these? All right, you got wars, these long, drawn-out wars, but you also have battles that come up. What's behind it? What causes this? Well, he gives us the answer in a second rhetorical question. He says, is it not this that your passions are at war within you? Now, he frames this as a question, I think, for a couple of reasons, but the main one is he wants to kind of disarm his audience here a little bit. Because again, if James had simply said, it's your passions that are the problem, we might get defensive and put our hands up. But by asking as a question, he says something like this. It's your passions, it's your desires that are behind all this conflict, isn't it? It's almost like he's inviting our agreement so that we would kind of hang our head and say, yeah, I guess you're right. It really is my desires that are the cause of conflict. Now, James has already talked about desires back in chapter 1. He said that temptation plays upon our desires. And here again, we're introduced to this idea of desire being the cause of conflict. Let's note a couple things about this, though. Number one, our desires cause a war in the heart, which spills over into our relationships. It causes a war in our heart that spills over into our relationships. Notice, by the way, in verse 1, he talks about quarrels and fights among you. That is, among you Christians, among you and your neighbor, among you and other people. There's conflict going on interpersonally. But then he says, isn't it your passions at war within you? Or a literal translation of that would be in your members. Now, it might be tempting to say, well, he's talking about the members of your church. But the way that James uses this term, members, is usually referring to the body. So he's talking about something going on. There's a war that's raging inside our hearts that spills over and affects our relationships. So what's the battle? What's the war that's going on inside? It's the war with our desires. There's what we know to be right, and then there's what we want. And oftentimes those two clash. We know that we ought to love others as Christ has loved us. We know that we ought to, you know, serve others. And if you're a believer, you've been taught this. But our desire is, I want to be first. I want to be served. And it's a selfish thing. In fact, look at the word he uses. He says, you, is it not your passions? Passions or desires. It's this Greek word, hedone, which you might even hear it in the word. It's where we get the term hedonism. Hedonism is the worldview which says all of life is about satisfying my desires. That is the chief end and goal of mankind, is my pleasure. Hedonism. And again, this idea here, not all desires are inherently evil. But with hedone, with these hedonistic desires, what is it all about? It's about me, about satisfying myself. It's extremely self-centered, as we're about to see. This is, I think, where a great deal of our conflicts come from, is from these me-centered desires. Notice, again, he says this war is going on within our hearts, within our lives. We have this battle with desire, what we want. It makes us controlled by this me-centered approach to life. And what happens? It clashes with others. If I'm all about serving self, well, what about when people don't make me number one? What about when people don't treat me the way I think I ought to be treated? What about when people don't give me what I want exactly when I want it? Well, I'm ready to fight them. Why? Because I've already determined I'm the center of the universe. And everything revolves around me. And if you can't get on board with that, you're the problem. That's where these fights come from. This war in our hearts, which spills over into our relationships. Secondly, our desires drive us to satisfy our lusts
and fight with those who get in our way. Again, these desires that we have long to be satisfied. They drive us to satisfy those lusts. We want what we want, and we want it now. And anybody who stands in the way of that or who gets in the way of us satisfying our desires, we're ready to fight them. And this is where a lot of that conflict comes from. Especially, you might think about this in marriage. Marriage is just two sinners, self-centered sinners, living life together. And so the husband wants something and the wife wants something. And sometimes those wants clash. You know, he wants a new motorcycle, she wants to renovate the kitchen. And then there's a clash and a battle that springs up. Again, when we're only thinking about ourselves and we're only driven by our desires, it leads us into conflict with others. This pattern, by the way, begins really early in our lives, doesn't it? I mean, what's the first thing that kids learn? Me, mine. So you put two kids together with a toy, and one of them claims it as their own. This is mine. And if the other child, the other toddler, wants to play with it, take it away from the first, he's likely to get clobbered, right? Because life's about me and my desires and what I want. And if you try and take that toy from me, you're going to get it. And then lastly, our desires are ultimately selfish. That's what James is saying. He says you're living for yourself. That's where this conflict comes from, selfish desires. Again, if you backtrack to chapter 3, what, verse 16 or so, it says there that the wisdom from below leads to selfish ambition. Selfish ambition. The desire to meet my needs and only my needs. That's where conflict comes from. So if we're asking the question, well, why is my life filled with so much turmoil? Why do I have so much trouble getting along with people? Could it be that you're an extremely self-centered person? That fulfilling your desires is number one? I thought of a perfect illustration for this idea of where conflicts come from. It comes from my own life, from my childhood. You may not know this about me, but I was a child soldier. At least that's how I thought of myself. I was engaged in several long-running wars, including the Great Mudball Wars. And like most conflicts, the Great Mudball Wars, nobody knows who fired the first shot, but it's pretty clear what the whole war was about. When I was growing up, we had some property that ended at a creek. There was a little creek that separated us from the neighbors on the back side. And across that creek, there was a rope swing that hung. And so we would spend hours of our day swinging back and forth, kind of Tarzan style, across the creek. And that was our play area. We loved it. Here's the thing. When you got finished playing with the rope, we would tie it up on our side of the creek. You'd tie it up around a tree. Because if you let it just dangle, it would hang in the middle of the creek. You'd have to wade out and get all muddy and wet getting the rope swing. So we would tie it up on our side of the creek. Everything was fine. Well, it turns out the neighbor kids across the creek also liked to play on the swing. So they would come down and they would play on the rope swing and they would tie it up on their side of the creek. So when we come down, it's not on our side anymore. We have to go across and claim it for ourselves. And this began the Great Mudball War, you know, where there was this feud with our neighbors. And there weren't any casualties in the Mudball Wars, but there was a lot of laundry that was done. Because as you can tell, the mudballs were the primary weapon of choice. But I think about that, and I look back on it, what caused that war? What caused the conflict with the neighbor kids? Well, it was the rope swing, right? We wanted the control of the rope swing. That's not it. It's, I want what I want. I want it on my side of the creek. I don't want it on your side. I want it on my side. I think that is a nice little picture of what's going on in our lives. And it's probably not rope swings and mud balls and creeks, but it's any number of things that we want. I want it now. The selfish desires that we have is what leads to conflict. Let's ask a second question, though. What happens when our desires go unmet? All right, so I want something, and I'm desiring self-centered goals. What happens when those goals are frustrated? Well, problems, more conflict, more battles, more wars. Again, let me turn back the clock here for a second. How do Young children deal with unmet desires. A baby or an infant doesn't get what they want, they scream and they cry and they kick and they shout. Now, as mature adults, we've learned different ways of coping with our unmet needs or desires. We don't scream and cry as much, but we still pout and whine and scheme and all kinds of other things. What happens when our desires go unmet? Let's look at verse 2. He says, you desire and you do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and you quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. So what happens when we don't get what we want? Well, what happens is first, we hate, but it doesn't help. We hate, but it doesn't help. The text begins by saying, you desire and do not have. There's the unmet desire. You know, I want something, but for some reason I can't get my hands on it. Maybe somebody else is in my way. So what do I do? It says, so you murder. Now, in the words of people my age and my generation, we would say, well, that escalated quickly. And indeed it does. It's like, wow, we went from desire, unmet desire, to murder? I actually thought about titling this message this morning, Diagnosis Murder, but I felt like that title was already taken. But that's conflict is leads to, in some cases, murder. Now, does James mean that the members of the church, the people who were reading this letter, were guilty of actually murdering their neighbor? I certainly hope not. Although, that is a possibility. It's not like Christians have never done anything this evil before. So there's a couple of ways we can take this expression, murder, in verse 2. He may be talking about murder as the ultimate end of unmet desires. In other words, if we lust and we pursue our desires but we can't have them, if taken to the extreme, it results in murder. That's true, if we take it all the way. But there's another option here as well, and I think probably more likely, is that James means this metaphorically. After all, he's talked about wars and battles metaphorically already. Now he says you murder, meaning you hate to the greatest degree. I think James is pulling and drawing here from Jesus. Remember, Christ taught in the Sermon on the Mount, if you hate your brother, you commit murder in your heart. It's what I like to call murder in the fourth degree. So you're all familiar with first degree murder, right? That's premeditated murder. There's also second degree murder, which is usually not premeditated, but still terrible thing, right? Somebody takes somebody's life. It wasn't planned beforehand, but it's still murder. Then there are some states which actually have third-degree murder, which, as I understand it, is pretty much manslaughter. But Jesus talks about fourth-degree murder, which is not murder at all, but it is certainly the hate, the malice aforethought, even if murder is not committed. That's what James, I think, is talking about here, fourth-degree murder. They may not have been guilty of actually murdering anyone, but they had murder in their hearts. You've heard the expression, if looks could kill, well, they had the look. And they were staring one another down. He says, listen, if you don't get what you want, you go to all kinds of extreme results. You notice, by the way, and it's here in this verse, sinful, misaligned desires lead us to alter our view of other people. They warp our view of other people. Instead of viewing others as human beings, created the image of God, people whom we ought to have respect and honor, no, people become either a vehicle to meet my desires or an obstacle in the way of my desires. People are either a vehicle to meet my desires or an obstacle in the way of my desires. So it warps how I view other people. Can you help me get what I want, or are you going to stand in the way of what I want? If you stand in the way, I will fight you to the death. That seems to be what James is getting at. We all could probably point to examples, or at least are familiar of examples with of people who view others just that way. They use others. They don't love. They don't treat people kindly, but see everybody as an ends to meeting their desires. I thought about this and thought, you know what, probably California is as good an example as I can think of. And there are two places in California where you see this pretty clearly, Silicon Valley and Hollywood. Because both are usually populated by young people who have strong desires. They want to make it big. They want to become the next huge thing. And oftentimes they end up treating people as a vehicle to getting what they want or an obstacle getting in the way. That's why both places are oftentimes referred to as being cutthroat. It's a cutthroat place, Hollywood, Silicon Valley, because everybody's trying to fulfill their desires and they are willing to destroy just about anybody who gets in the way of that. So we hate, but it doesn't help, right? He says in verse 2, you desire and you do not have, so you murder. Still don't have, but we hate. So we hate, but it doesn't help. Secondly, we lust, but we are frustrated. He says in verse 2, you covet and you cannot obtain. So what do? He says you fight and you quarrel. Same words, by the way, that he used in the previous verse. So we declare war. We fight battles, all because we lust, but we do not have. We're frustrated. We don't get what we want. And so what happens? We declare war. And this is a sad thing, because sinful desires will never be satisfied. They defy. There's never enough of these sinful desires. Thomas Brooks, from many, many generations back, said it this way. He said, a little will satisfy nature. Even less will satisfy grace, but nothing will satisfy men's lusts. Nothing will satisfy men's lusts. So what happens when our desires go unmet, when we don't get our way? Well, we get violent. We fight and we struggle. We make it all about us. And there's a perfect example of this in the Bible. A rather familiar story you may remember from 1 Kings 21. There was a king named Ahab. And next door to his property was a little vineyard that he wanted. Why the king of Israel wanted this particular vineyard, I don't know. He could have many others, I'm sure. So he goes to the owner, a man named Naboth, and says, Naboth, I want your vineyard. I'll give you another vineyard if you want it. I'll give you whatever price you want to charge for it. And Naboth says, no, this is my ancestral land. I'm not parting with it. And what does Ahab do? Well, he goes back to his house. He lays down on his couch. He refuses to eat. He whines. He cries. He wails. He carries on like a child. And soon Jezebel comes to him and says, his wife, who was equally evil, and she says to Ahab, what's all the fuss about? And he says, I want Naboth's vineyard, but he won't give it to me. Jezebel says, hush now, I'll get it for you. And in that case, it wasn't metaphorical murder. It was full-on first-degree murder. She kills Naboth to attain for Ahab what he wanted. And that's how it plays out. You know, maybe we don't murder our neighbor. Maybe it's not a vineyard, but we want, but we can't have. And so it makes us miserable. And we're willing to hurt other people and to hate them. All because our desires go unmet. So let me ask a third question. Why are our desires unmet? Well, the last part of the verse helps us with that. Why don't we have what we want? I think somebody might look at these verses and say, well, of course I get mad when I don't get what I want. You know, that's natural. So the real question is, well, why don't you get what you want? Is it that you want the wrong thing? He says at the end of verse 2, you do not ask, or you do not have because you do not ask. So there are two reasons why our desires are unmet according to this passage. Number one, we don't ask God. We don't ask God. Earlier in James, we read that God is the giver of every good and perfect gift. But instead of taking our desires to him, we strive to satisfy our desires in our own way. Maybe one of the reasons we don't ask God is because we know the things we desire are not good. They're selfish. They're sinful. And so it seems we at least have the the understanding in our own heart to say, I'm not going to ask God for that because God's not going to give me this sinful, selfish thing. But we still want it. So we still pursue it. We don't ask God. Now, please notice in verse 2, he's not saying that you don't have because you didn't ask. If you ask, it's like a magic bullet. It's the, you know, kind of like the divine vending machine. If you ask, you get it. That's not what he's saying. In fact, the next verse makes it clear. He says, you ask and you do not receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your own passions. So we don't ask God because our desires are oftentimes sinful. Or sometimes our desires are legitimate. Maybe we want something that's not evil. But we think to ourselves, instead of asking God, we're just going to get it in my own way. And so we strive and we fight and we try and get what we want. This is how D. Edmund Hebert writes. He says, instead of turning to God as the giver of every good and perfect gift, they attempt to satisfy their gnawing wants with their own efforts. Their approach is self-centered and worldly. Instead of wrestling with God in prayer, they wrangle bitterly with men. We do not have because we do not ask God. Secondly, we do not have because we ask with wrong motives. He says this in verse 3. You ask and you do not receive because you ask wrongly. So maybe James's audience here is saying, well, yeah, we have prayed about this, but we still don't have what we want. James says, How did you ask? Again, this isn't a formula. It's not like, oh, you didn't say the magic words, so you didn't get it. No, he says, the reason God doesn't answer your prayer is because your prayer is evil. You want to just spend it on your own desires. I think that's what he means by you ask wrongly. In other words, you asked in a selfish way. There's another biblical story, I think, that helps us here. It's the story of the prodigal son. Parable that Jesus told. There, the son comes to the father and says, Father, give me my inheritance. Give me what's coming to me. And in that case, the father does give it to him. But what's his goal? Why did he ask for that? So he could go out and spend. By the way, same word that's used here in James 4:3 is the same word that's used in the parable of the prodigal son, spend. He took the money and he spent it on wild living. He spent it on parties and on things that didn't matter. So if you have a child comes to you and says, hey, can you give me $500? Wouldn't it matter what he was going to use it for? I mean, you wouldn't want to give it to him if he was going to use it for destructive, self-destructive activities. So we ask with the wrong motives. Again, I think that's what he means by you ask amiss or you ask wrongly. You see, I think James's audience, they remembered Jesus' words from Matthew 7:7, which says, ask and it will be given to you, seek and you will find. They remembered that. But they conveniently forgot about Matthew 6:33, where it says, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. They got in the habit of saying, well, ask and it will be given to you. No matter what it is, no matter what I want, if I ask God, he'll give it to me. And then when they don't receive it, they say, well, what happened? What's wrong? Well, maybe you weren't seeking first the kingdom of God. Instead, they wanted to spend it on their own pleasure. Peter H. Davids, who's written on James, says this. I think this is quite helpful. He says, this is not the trusting child asking for a meal. It's the greedy child asking for the best piece. Or a spoiled child asking for his own way. They are asking God to bless their schemes, and God will have no part of it. One of the reasons we don't have the things that we desire is because we're desiring, you know, we're scheming after what we want, and God says, I'm not going to have part of that. I'm not going to bless you or give to you what is you intend to spend on your own pleasures, on self-focused needs. So as we look at this passage, what needs to change? Here's conflicts. Here's turmoil and fights in our lives. We oftentimes find ourselves at odds with other people because we have desires. We have things we want, and people won't cave to our desires. So we fight them. and we argue and we struggle. What needs to change? The desires, isn't it? What does our heart long for? What do we want? This is what we need. This is where we need the transforming work of the Holy Spirit in our lives to change what we desire. It also, by the way, presupposes the gospel, does it not? Because in ourselves, in our sinful state, all our desires are corrupted by sin. That's not to say all of our desires immediately change to good ones as soon as we follow Christ. There's a process to it. But we need to, first of all, we need to bow the knee to the Lord, and then we need to have our desires changed and transformed by that same grace. We need to long for things that are good, the things that God longs to give to us, rather than lusting after hedonistic pleasure. We should long for Christ and the goodness, the good gifts which he gives. So what I want us to do is take a look at our lives and ask, where is this conflict coming from? And I hope your days are not just a constant war zone. But no doubt, there's conflict at points in your life. Fights with others. You know, we contend, we try to get our way, we yell, we slam doors. Why? Why is it like that? It's because we have sinful and misaligned desires. So since we've been talking about diagnosing conflict today, I want to leave you with a couple of diagnostic questions for your own life. Number one, when you find yourself getting mad, ask, what is it I want? When you find yourself getting mad, ask, what is it that I want? What am I after? Why am I getting mad about this in the first place? Is it because I want to be proven right that I'm willing to fight? Is it because I want to be seen as smarter, as better? Is it because I want to get my own way? We already talked about church fights. Sometimes churches get into horrific battles because somebody says, I want our church to be this way. I want to get my way with our church. Somebody else has an opposing idea and the two sides clash. So ask yourself, what is it that I want? Often you will find that if you're mad, it's because someone has stepped on the kingdom of me. Somebody has trespassed upon your glorious kingdom. What is it that I want? And perhaps a follow-up question to that could be, how can I want what's right? What's the right thing to want in this circumstance? So when you find yourself getting mad, ask, what is it that I want? Secondly, when you find yourself getting mad, ask, how am I treating other people? How am I treating other people? This is pretty basic to the conflicts, is that when we get into the mode where I'm mad and I'm fighting with you, suddenly that person becomes the enemy. Even if they're your spouse, even if they're your child, even if they're your friend, fellow church member, they become the enemy. And we get that warped view of people that I talked about earlier, where they're either a vehicle for our desires or an obstacle to it. Is that how God would want you to view that person? Is that how God would want you to view your spouse, as an enemy who's an obstacle to your desires? A follow-up question you could ask is, how should I be treating people in this situation? Number three, when you find yourself getting mad, ask, have I prayed about this? Have I prayed about this? James says part of your problem here is that you do not have because you don't ask. And then when you do ask, you ask for things so that you can spend them on yourself. Selfish prayers. So let me ask, have you prayed about this? I mean, we find our blood starting to boil and we start to get into conflict with somebody. Have we prayed about this? Have we come before the Lord on this topic? Because whenever we haven't, and whenever our lives are not submitted to the Lord in prayer, oftentimes we can get into bitter conflicts. Now, there's more we could say here about how to fix this problem of conflict. But I'm going to save it because verses 7 through 10 of this chapter really give us the clearest answer. And it's basically this, it's repentance. If we have a selfish, misaligned desires that lead us into conflict with others, what should we do? The answer is repent. Repent. So wherever those conflicts lie in your life, oftentimes they're a result of our selfish desires starting wars with others when our desire should be Christ, His will, and His way.